Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversations with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Thursday, the 10th of October. On our program today, the new sports minister, Gayton McKenzie, on a South African Formula One Grand Prix. Shosholoza mail operations stopped in their tracks as civil society organizations cry corruption. Are shadow bankers powering organized crime in South Africa? And why an expert says neglecting mental health in the workplace is going to cost employers dearly. Now, if he were successful, it would cost tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of rand, but the return on investment might be impressive. Sports Minister Gayton McKenzie is pushing hard for the return of Formula One to South Africa. In response and in a statement issued by Motorsport South Africa, it says it's aware the ministry has engaged in discussions with the global Formula One management team and is committed to bringing the sport back to the country. Minister McKenzie joined us earlier today, and I asked him firstly why he was throwing the kitchen sink at the project.
Oh, I'm really throwing the kitchen sink. That I like the description. You know what? For me, it's that I'm a Formula One fan, number one, on a personal level, but also the fact that, you know, South Africa is full of motorsport enthusiasts. You know, petrol heads, and we love the sport. And I don't think the sport has really shown us the love back that we have shown towards the sport. Formula One cannot truly be an international competition investing a continent, which is Africa. And I just think that, you know, it will showcase our country. Formula One is not just a race. It's an experience. It's a tourist mirror, because people can see how your country looks. You know, it's just so many things that come with Formula One. You look at Hungary, for instance. There are 300,000 people at the F1 in Hungary and 200,000 from the outside. I mean, and normal F1 supporter is not a, and I say it respectfully, but it's not a one-star visitor. You know, they stay three-star, four-star, five-star, even seven-star hotels. And our country needs that. And I think that is why I'm throwing the sink, as you say, at them.
Minister, you make your point, but two key questions here is that we still don't know what this is going to cost the fiscus, and perhaps more importantly, where the money is going to come from.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think firstly you must understand that South Africa has been in the past, as I would say, twice. They twice went to F1 and they said we're going to host it. It never happened. So we've been to the altar twice, but we never got married. And because of egos and political interference and just egomaniacs fighting with each other and putting the country second. Firstly, I think the money part for me is not a massive problem, because corporate South Africa is keen. Corporate South Africa has been phoning my ear off, saying, listen, don't forget us, we want to help. You know, we've got a very vibrant and involved corporate community in South Africa. The problem comes in where corporates are getting a raw deal, because corporates give money and then federations and sports people don't account for the money and then complain that, yeah, corporates don't help us, we can't take our athletes, we can't take our players or our creatives, this, but they're not telling the full story. Corporates are eager to help. Corporates want to help, but corporates has not been given what should be given to them, which is like accountability, what happened to their money. So where the money is coming from, to answer your question, it will come from the corporate world. It's also a commercial deal. Don't underestimate the fact that people pay to watch F1. So they're smart entrepreneurs that will put this together, and I think my corporate knowledge also plays a huge role in knowing that this event, if it breaks even, we've won big time. But government support, there will definitely be government support, make no mistake about that, because we get our returns sometimes not in cash value, but we get our returns in tourism, in the country being showcased. So yeah, that is the least of my problems, where the money would come from, because a lot of people want to, even at countries from outside South Africa, saying, listen, we are willing to help you guys. When you need some help, just scream.
Minister, which corporates have been phoning you?
Well, you know, I don't put people on the spot, but I can tell you a whole lot of, you can see the, I'll make you an example. We're launching Spinning on Saturday. You've already at South Sea saying, being a headline sponsor of the Spinning. I'll just make you one example, two, three examples. South Sea already said, listen, they're already sponsoring the Spinning, a headline sponsor. You saw Red Bull this weekend saying, when you bring it, we are here to help you. You know, I can tell you, I've not had a meeting with any major sponsor and they didn't mention F1. So, as I'm saying to you, government, you know, yesterday, during break at cabinet, the president called me. And he says, how far are you with F1? Yeah, I found that hilarious. You know, just during break, the president would always have his coffee outside. He called me. I thought I'd be in trouble. And he said, how far are you with F1? And I mean, that's the level of interest. And the president just said to me that, what I've gathered is a Ferrari. He didn't say it, but I gathered by what our discussion that he must be Team Ferrari.
Minister, let me put to you that is it fair to spend so much money on an elite sport, which Formula One really is, where it could be better spent on sporting and cultural development priorities?
Well, you know, if there's no returns, I would think it would be very unfair to spend that type of money if there's no returns. F1, I tell you, countries are falling over their feet to get F1. F1 will create jobs, and F1 will create opportunities. F1 will introduce people to the sport that has not been introduced to the sport at the moment. So I can tell you what you're saying. I can't argue that it's an elite sport, but I don't think you can argue with the fact that when I tell you that, you know, you look at the rugby team, the Springbok rugby team. We used to look at it as an aloof for white people only. That's why we wanted the emblem gone many years ago. But what is happening now, the ordinary man on the street is supporting Springbok, right. The Springbok team. So what I'm saying to you is that, I'm to say, but I'm going to give you a counter argument just to say by saying that, you know, when you bring the F1, you're not only bringing it for the sport, for entertainment. That would have been irresponsible of me if we bring it for entertainment value that it obviously delivers. But I'm talking here about South African people. They will come here for the first time in their lives. They will come and spend dollars here. They will, and those dollars will create jobs in euros, will create jobs in this country.
Have you quantified, Minister, how many jobs would be created?
Well, what we are doing is Supersport has done a... They've commissioned an even international and local company. I think they've commissioned two reports, which basically shows you that the value that F1 coming here that it will bring, and the fact that, you know, if you want to, we are a developing country, and as a developed, let me make you an example with one country, Azerbaijan, Baku, the Baku race in Azerbaijan. Who in their right minds in South Africa would have said, I'm going to Azerbaijan. But I found so many South Africans in Azerbaijan, and they contribute towards the tourism industry. We know now about Baku. It's not just a country there in the Bundus because of F1. F1 has really moved on. F1 has become basically this one thing that you have the F1, you're on everybody's lips. And tourism creates jobs. Sports tourism creates jobs. In South Africa, I'm introducing South Africa to the business of sport, and not only to the entertainment of sport, the business of sport.
Right.
And I think F1 is a business that will, and what do we have to lose? Those corporates that we're going to pay wouldn't necessarily, if they don't pay for F1, take that money and put it in cricket or in soccer for that matter. They wouldn't do. They wouldn't necessarily, it's not guaranteed. But now we're going to them and say, can you pay for that? We've got business people falling over their feet saying, we want to bring F1, we will pay for it. Because they understand, and I can understand as a ex-business person, why they can't do it. Because there's value. There's value in F1.
That's the sports minister, Gayton McKenzie. I guess the big question is President Ramaphosa a secret Ferrari fan? Part two of the interview, focusing on the Olympic Games on the next MoneyWeb at Midday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As the December holiday season approaches, many South African families look forward to traveling by rail and are going to make other plans, though, it seems. The Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, we know it better as PRASA, has suspended all but one long-distance route. No clear date has been provided for when the services will resume. You'll know well that these struggles are exacerbated by corruption scandals and the infamous too-tall trains deal that have left the rail structure or rail infrastructure in disarray. Joining me now from the Unite Union is Joseph Mason, legal officer. Joseph, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. What, in your opinion, has led then to the collapse of these important routes?
Well, as you correctly pointed out, you know, it's really started with corruption, the large scale corruption in the Swifambo case, that is the tall trains saga, where PRASA contracted for 3.5 billion rand to buy upwards of 70 locomotives that were desperately needed to service their long distance lines. They ended up paying 2.6 billion rand and only received 13 locomotives in 2015. They then, a few years later, auctioned those off for a fraction of the price. They only regained about 65 million of that 2.6 billion that they paid. So that's the one angle. The other angle is that they do share the line, these long distance lines, with Transnet, and we know that we know the issues that Transnet has faced, and so the actual railways are often not up to standard.
Yeah. Why is it taking so long for PRASA to secure enough replacement locomotives then to restore full service?
It really does baffle one's mind, because so since 2020, PRASA has been trying to get the rest of the locomotives that are too tall for our railways from the European company Stadler Foslo, that currently has 19 of the locomotives that were built. The rest have not been built, and that whole contract was declared invalid and set aside. So PRASA, since 2020, has stated that it wants to take those locomotives back that are not fit for purpose. However, it also auctioned off those very same locomotives for a fraction of their price. So it seems strange. They're seeming to do both things at once. They want to take these tall locomotives and then modify them to fit our railways, but in these intervening 4 years, no attempts have been made to procure other locomotives that are fit for purpose already, which would shorten the timeline, and in the process are leaving many of our poor citizens who can't afford the price of a plane, who can't afford the price of a bus, to not visit their family, not go on holiday, not pursue employment opportunities in other cities. So it's really had a massive impact.
And no immediate solutions, I'm hearing, to address the crisis itself. So it remains in a stalemate, and effectively passenger rail service in South Africa is all but dead.
So yes, long distance passenger rail service is all but dead, and they seem to be relying on a contract that has been declared invalid, and so to make things worse, Stadler Rail is under liquidation proceedings, and so that makes it even harder to regain the money back that was paid. before, you know, even the locomotives were received, and or to regain these locomotives that would then need to be modified. So yes, it seems like they're sitting on their hands waiting for something, some sort of legal process to you know, be completed, but they haven't been open about what stage that is at, where, you know, what the negotiations are with the liquidators are, you know, and how they would actually and the viability of modifying these locomotives.
And just finally, Joseph, when I mention these two words to any union representative, they tend to run a country mile. But if I say private partnership, how do you react to that?
So I think just to say, so I'm not a part of a union.
I do understand,
Unite Behind,
but you're
Unite Behind is a non-profit. So
question remains.
Public-private partnership. We don't, you know, I don't think we would just be on those words, you know, eschew that as a solution. We would have to, you know, evaluate what the actual proposal is, ensuring that above all affordability for commuters is retained, and that safety and security and reliability are achieved. But yes, if there is a viable proposal out there, then we would be for it. But we haven't seen anything as yet.
Joseph Mason, thank you very much indeed. Legal officer, Unite Behind. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's continue the corruption and malfeasance theme then. Money laundering is often seen as a hidden crime, yet it fuels nearly every other form of organized crime. As South Africa's financial sector grapples with corruption scandals, illicit flows of money are becoming harder to trace and prosecute. Dierwald van Rensburg is an investigative journalist at Amabungani and is busy with a series on this particular issue and joins me on the program now. So, Dierwald, then, why is money laundering considered the backbone of organized crime? Let's start there.
Well, the point is that when we think of crime, we think of, you know, murder, extortion, we think of corruption, we think of things that leave bodies on the ground, you know, drugs, guns, all of that. But the fact is, no one could do anything, any organized kind of crime, unless there's something to do with the money afterwards. And that's where money laundering comes in. Without money laundering, you really, you know, the business of crime becomes impossible, just like any business is impossible without a bank. And that is why we are trying to focus on that. The idea is that, you know, it's the organized crime that enables organized crime. I think on that basis alone, it's worth looking at.
And the sense I'm getting is that the criminals are becoming more adept and a lot more creative in the way in which they do it.
Oh, they do all sorts of things. It really is quite fascinating, actually. It's impressive. Sometimes, you know, I have to sit back and whistle and say, well, that was very clever. And the way you organize ways to get money out of the country, for instance, the fake pretenses. I mean, the primitive way is to do fake business, to say, no, I'm exporting rice, and you create fake invoices and so on. But it's really gone beyond that these days. And you can fabricate entire legal processes. You kind of get someone in a multinational that you can corrupt, and they create fake business within their business, that kind of thing.
And Dierwald, what about the formal financial sector within South Africa itself, the role that they play in facilitating illicit money flows, and whether they are sometimes just ignorant of what is happening beneath their noses?
There are kind of three parties you have to think about here. I mean, okay, you have the criminals, and you have the banks on the one hand, and you have, you know, regulatory authorities. And even though, you know, we're writing about criminals, we are implicitly writing about the failure of accountability and the failure of regulation and the failure of the banking sector, which implements regulation. So in our first story, for instance, we were talking about the Reserve Bank and Rand Refinery, which is a kind of special creature of statute as well, even though it's a private company. They may have seen suspicious things happening, which was the surge in the buying of Kruger Rands, which introduced gold into the illicit sector, but they didn't really do anything about it. And they allowed people into the primary market, which they had to authorize, who were exceedingly dodgy. it took them a long time to cotton on to the fact, or if they cottoned on, to actually act on that knowledge. And the second thing is, and I think this will become clear in our series, is that this cornerstone of the banks and their supposed role in stopping crime is the suspicious transaction reports, the fact that you have to see suspicious behavior, report it, act on it. And we will see a lot of suspicious activity that was not reported and not acted on, and things that are really as clear as day.
So why and how is the governance or gatekeeping failing in that respect then?
Well, I mean, that remains the golden question. One wants to be cynical perhaps and say, well, there's a lot of business and you don't want to, you know, rock the boat unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, there is corruption in the private sector, obviously. In many cases, you'll find the whole forex department of a bank basically in on it because they earn fees and commission on the, you know, trade of money. So you have kind of rogue traders, you have bankers who will turn a blind eye to bad paperwork that clearly isn't kosher. And we will be talking about a lot of those kind of people. But you also, you can't put it all down to a few bad apples, you know, proverbially. There is just a failure to catch these things. And we keep noticing, right? We keep seeing these tiny fines being given to banks because, you know, there's some kind of problem with the screening of customers and it's dressed up in extremely dry language. But those fines are minute. They are, you know, a couple of thousand rands for business that totals billions of rands. So it's a not even just a cost of business, it's an immaterial cost of business.
As a result of the work that you've done so far, have you formulated an opinion then on what needs to be done to strengthen the fight against money laundering?
Well, like I said, the kind of point where regulation is supposed to be implemented, by and large, is the banks. And the system through which suspicious activity is reported and acted on simply doesn't work at all, like not even remotely. And so I think the thresholds and the kind of muscle behind interpreting what is suspicious has to change. I mean, we because we regulate at a low threshold, actually, that's a problem. I mean, we should be spending a lot more time looking at things that's 10 million plus. That would have caught a lot of the people we are going to be writing about. And secondly, we have this problem of kind of authorities that don't speak to each other. So a lot of the good work is done by SARS in terms of catching and investigating people. But as it says itself, it doesn't really care that they're laundering money. It cares that they pay tax on their criminal money. And the Reserve Bank itself has very little power except to seize bank accounts. And those bank accounts are usually empty. So, I mean, insofar as crime is detected and properly investigated, it's done so by authorities who really don't want to or cannot do anything about it.
And just a final one, including the tobacco industry in this country, are there other sectors that you have discovered that are more vulnerable or more open to this than others?
Well, tobacco and gold are always the obvious culprits, and that's because they, you know, it involves a great deal of cash. But anything that involves a lot of cash is vulnerable. So, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but fast-moving consumer goods will feature because you have a lot of trade and a lot of cross-border trade in basically food. And that also creates opportunities. But anything really that is high volume and involves a lot of money is vulnerable.
I'm going to leave it there. Dierwald van Rensburg, thank you very much indeed. From Amar Bongani, appreciate your time today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let me close the circle on this. And corruption, I would contend, is a cause of stress in the workplace, or at least one of them. And to that end, the explosive rise of global crises and relentless job demands are unleashing unmatched levels of anxiety. That is amplifying mental health issues in the workplace. The World Health Organization has revealed that a staggering 15% of working-age adults are currently grappling with mental disorder. More now from Dr. Chris van Straten, Global Health Advisor, Clinical Governance at International SOS. A very warm welcome to you. How serious then is the problem?
Jeremy, yeah, to your point, I think there's many issues. One is globally, there's obviously cause for concern. We have multiple global conflicts. We have the constant stresses related to climate change. The economics of getting by for the average South African certainly has to stress. And I think our aspect social media, for example, many of these tools are incredible, but seem to be adding to some of the levels of stress people experience. And that brings me to the next thing, and you'll probably focus on this point too. So in the workspace, where I, as an example, spend most of my day and many of our colleagues, trying to make that a safe space to encourage acknowledging mental health issues, but also steps we could take to address mental health issues, I think becomes increasingly important.
Let's look at that in just a moment. But Chris, what I am interested in is depression and anxiety and the impact on workplace productivity. It must be ratcheting up, surely.
It is ratcheting up, and I think there's many reasons for that. Again, as we said, there's geopolitical and economic reasons for that. But we also know that different kinds of work environments, whether you're a late-night worker, shift worker, all the demands with the capacity and tools versus demand or load, if there's too big a difference there, people will become more anxious, more depressed, and it can spiral, can become a negative loop on itself.
Do you think, Chris, that workers sometimes take advantage of the situation? Is that, you know, there might be other reasons for non-performance, but they simply default to a mental health excuse?
Oh, I'm sure they do. So, human nature and human behavior, many people will take a gap and misuse or use labels. However, I don't think that should detract from our discussion that mental health, anxiety, are real issues, just like having hypertension. Mm. If you have hypertension and it's missed and you end up having that heart attack, that will impact your life, your family, your ability to earn, and your company's bottom line. Whereas, and in the same token, if you pick it up early, you're on the correct treatment, lifestyle modification, you can prevent that heart attack. And with the mental health issues, there's also a lot of a stigma around it. Many people don't want to say, hey, I'm anxious or depressed. They don't want to appear weak or vulnerable. And then you can also set yourself up for down the line reduced effectiveness or needing to take sick leave and get professional care. So for me, the focus should be more on that. So do people use medicine and medically related topics as excuses? Yes, always have and always probably will. But I don't think that should detract from the honest discussion of how do we make the workplace a better place in all aspects.
All right. So in terms of that honest discussion, then, in your opinion, how can businesses better align their strategies to support employee well-being?
Some of the first steps is just the basic education. And it can be a tick box exercise, but hopefully you want to get beyond that, where it's educating staff, enabling staff to be able to come forward and discuss when required, if it's having impact. The other issue here, too, is often, and it's true for all things, whether it's business, money, finances, medicine, you have to be able to measure a situation to be able to take logical decisions or steps to improve a situation. And I'm just going to use an example here. A particular client that we supported, they have a very large facility in northern Mozambique. You may recall several years back, there was a terrorist attack. Several people in that facility were badly damaged. And initially, we physically supported that and did the medical management. What was really interesting and challenging for that particular business was that months later, people still working in that facility were experiencing very real anxiety, very real depression, and for some very obvious reasons. And the solution to that wasn't a nice webinar and a pat on the back. Mm. The solution was a survey, boots on the ground, understanding why that stress response was there. We know the trigger, that was obvious, but understanding what was happening in that workspace post that stressor. And then this was interesting, a international specialist with experience in these kind of situations came and rolled out a pretty unique solution, using telemedicine solutions, using really for almost each person that was suffering some kind of PTSD or depression, anxiety, a one-on-one, either via telemedicine or regular interactions. And we were then also able to measure the difference over time. And over 18 months, there was a very significant turnaround. Mm. One, in terms of people's reported stresses and depression, anxiety. Two, you could measure the productivity gains. So for me, the big message here too is, yes, we've got this now, this media experience of being able to state things and make it visible. But people also need to know, like hypertension, there are very real pragmatic things that can be done. It includes measuring. It includes gaining, contextualizing for that business and location, and then the appropriate tools, and not whitewashing it like we often hear with, let's say, climate change or CO2 right. emissions. Very real interventions for a very real measurable problem.
And that's Chris, finally then, none of this is going to happen without the right company leadership in addressing and mitigating anxiety, burnout and depression. But the sense I have is that all too often executives simply shunt this to the margins.
100%. And I think, again, why this is a great opportunity to be able to step forward, step up and go, there are institutions. At International SOS, we are privileged to work with some of the Fortune 500 companies globally. And we have seen in some of these companies some impressive leadership. So again, it's not to whitewash and say, hey, it's all going to be perfect and the leaders must stand up and say some nice stuff. But what we have seen with some really big players globally, impressive, humble, honest communication that then can feed down. And you've got to focus around the policy and procedures. All HR departments have them. And if they're a tick box, you're going to fail. If it's a genuine, well-structured, here's the policy, here's the procedure, and here are the mechanisms we've put in place, whether it's an open door policy or you can escalate or whistleblow, or if you're just having a bad day and need to talk to someone, here are the different tools, whether it's through telemedicine or consulting that you can take, it then becomes a very, you can action this as opposed to, I think what it was 10, 15 years ago when we were students was very much, it was a nice idea and you had meetings about it, as opposed to something now that actually has structure, that has been implemented by some of the Fortune 500 companies and is showing return investment. Thanks, Jeremy.
Dr. Chris von Straten, thank you very much indeed. Global Health Advisor at the organization International SOS. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. On our last online poll, the economic impact of the Middle East crisis, 32% of our respondents saying we are feeling it already, 68% believe it will worsen. Today, does South Africa need a Formula One Grand Prix? Yes, no, or as long as it's at Kyalami. If you have a view on that, you can participate either on X or on LinkedIn. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.